centre at 6. It's understood the first two people to be diagnosed with coronavirus in the UK had recently travelled to China. The patients who are being treated at a specialist centre in Newcastle are from the same family. Meanwhile, 7 coaches carrying 83 Britons who've arrived from Wuhan are on their way to a facility on the Wirral, where they'll spend 2 weeks in quarantine. Health Minister Joe Churchill explains how it'll work.
Families will be together and individuals will be on their own. The exact specifics I'm not willing to go into at the moment, but making sure everybody's comfortable, that everybody has what they require, we're seeing to that.
European leaders have expressed their regret over the UK's imminent departure from the EU. Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says each side will fight for their interests in the upcoming trade discussions. Britain will officially leave the bloc at 11 tonight. SNP MP Pete Wishart says this will further calls for Scottish independence.
We are a European, modern European nation. We value our European Union connections, and we're mourning the deprivation of our European citizenship. And, you know, like, we're just not going to put up with this.
Airbus has agreed to pay a £3 billion fine to settle a criminal investigation for bribery. More than £833 million of it will be paid into the UK. Police in London recorded almost 300 sexual offences by private hire drivers in 2018. That's an increase of 81% on the year before. A prototype running shoe worn by Eliud Kipchoge that helped him become the first athlete to run a sub-2-hour marathon will be banned, but World Athletics have stopped short of totally outlawing Nike's controversial Vaporfly range. And Dancing on Ice professional Hamish Gammon says the truth will come out in the end after he split with his partner Caprice on the show. Writing on social media, he says he's not okay. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday at 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's Steve Smith. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast news at 7, well, coronavirus, of course. And also the deal of the century, or recipe for war. Telling the Palestinians to move out of East Jerusalem, something they say they're simply not prepared to do. We compare this week's Israel-Palestine peace deal to the 1995 Oslo Accords, which hit the buffers at Israel's biggest ever peace rally in November that year, when Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. The assassin, Yigal Amir, is still in jail, but his wife, Larissa Timbobla Amir, is now running for the Knesset. That's chutzpah for you. Julian Assange's French lawyer, Juan Branco, is speaking in a couple of hours' time, down at the Chelsea Tavern here in Easton for Bristol 24/7 from 6:30 till 8:30pm tonight. So we have him here too, if you couldn't make that one. And as the Russians deploy their S-400 missiles, surface-to-air missiles, and Putin's hypersonic missiles can target anywhere on Earth, within a few minutes, the Pentagon's moving out into space. Their new space force. And back to the 1946 Nuremberg trials. OSS lawyer William Wild Bill Donovan persuaded the highest surviving Nazi leader Hermann Göring to turn Queen's evidence to testify publicly about all he knew before submitting to be executed by firing squad, rather than the hanging as the judges initially wanted. But what happened? He never did it. The mysterious death of US Third Army General George Patton in December 1945, how his cards were marked before D-Day, and why Eisenhower sacked him 2 months before he died. Plus, the man that confessed in the 1970s to killing him, supposedly. Patton's crime? Speaking his mind. And on the trail of Martin Bormann, we were planned to do that last week. No time last week, we'll do it tonight. We go to Buenos Aires in 1972 to see what local people there believed whether they believed he'd been found or not, and what his fate should be. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, mild, light rain this weekend, 10 degrees Celsius roughly. Sunny periods tomorrow, but rain on Sunday. Next week, coolish, fairly bright until Wednesday evening. Thursday and Friday, cloudy, but a little chance of rain. Next weekend is the 8th and 9th of February. Temperatures rising as the rain comes in over the weekend, next weekend, and the week after next, gloomy, but only light rain. So that's Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news, it's Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley's Steve Smith. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thank you very much.
I think you are the newest but one councillor.
I am. Yeah. I am now, as of a couple of weeks ago, from the Bridlington by-election, yes. But
The big news, obviously, of the day. Well, I say news, it will be news after it happens, because there's quite a few of us that think, well, with all the promises of Theresa May that never materialised, is it really going to happen at 11 o'clock tonight?
I think we're past the point of no return now. Are we T-minus 5 hours or something now? Yeah, it's happening. And, you know, I think we've finally come to the end of, what's it been, 3.5 years since the referendum, and a few years more before that, of constantly fighting and arguing over, are we going to go or aren't we going to go? This isn't the end. There's a lot more to do after this. But at least that decision finally is made. It's happening. And I really hope that slowly we can start to heal some of those divisions.
Like someone that voted Leave.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. Why?
Democracy was the main thing. I want to be able to vote for the people that make the laws that I have to live by. And I think it's been widely acknowledged, and I'm sure we'll get some disagreement on this, but it's been acknowledged that the EU has had a democratic deficit for some time. That was a short-term thing. In the long term, though, I've felt for a long time that we have never sat comfortably as the UK with the long-term direction that the EU is going in. From the Maastricht Treaty onwards, it's been moving slowly but surely, with a kind of incremental ratchet effect, towards a federal future and towards becoming a state. And that's never been something that we in the UK have really fitted in with or really been comfortable with. We didn't go into the single currency. We didn't sign the social chapter. We had all various opt-outs and rebates. And I think if it didn't happen now, it was going to happen at some point.
Well, you talk about a democratic deficit, but actually the European Parliament's far more democratic than our Parliament. For a start, you get first past the post, and secondly, you get a much wider, proper spread of opinion. I mean, the reason you're saying that is because the Conservative is one of the two big parties in Britain that benefits from first past the post, and you can manage to squeak in a general election with a whacking great majority, even though you don't even necessarily have the majority of the votes.
Yeah, the reason I'm saying that is because the European Parliament isn't actually in charge of anything. So it might be democratically elected, and we can have an argument about different voting systems. I don't think there is a perfect voting system. There are flaws in whichever one. But regardless of how democratically it's elected, it's not where the power sits.
Martin, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the problem with the European Parliament is it's not. You could argue that it's not where the power sits, but it's the participation level in European elections used to be pitiful. It's only because we've had these rows that you've got certain numbers of people out. I mean, basically, it was the sort of thing that people. I mean, bit like local elections, people thought it didn't matter and they didn't participate. So the European Parliament has got limited legitimacy because of that. But at the same time, of course. It was the European Union is effectively a union of national states, which is what makes it so messy. And there's bound to be, you know, different national states have got different interests and so on. Some are in the euro, some are out of the euro. I never saw it as some sort of overarching super state, because it's basically such a shambles because of the nature of the beast, you know.
Yeah. The problem is, though, that it's not a union of separate states. It was. That's, you know, 40-odd years ago, whatever it was when we went in, that's what it was. But since then, and I think I'm probably quoting Daniel Hannan here, but it's now got an anthem and a flag and a parliament and a president and all the trappings of a state, and it's moving ever more in that direction.
Well,
which is,
I think there's an awful lot of obstacles in the way of that happening. It's an aspiration by many politicians in Europe that it should be, but the reality is, in practice, that it ain't.
Okay, but it's halfway there.
The person that more than anyone else probably made Brexit happen, I mean, I think maybe before we hear from Farage, I mean, surely we aren't actually leaving, are we? Martin, we're going to still be in the customs union. We're going to be in the single market.
We're still going to be under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. Rules and regulations will carry on for one more year, but the British government made it clear that they're not going to extend the transition period, which means...
So we're like Norway for a year, are we?
We're like Norway for a year. But, of course, at the end of that year, the government didn't have to do this, but they've already ruled out extension. And that means we're likely going to get a no-deal Brexit.
Why would you want to be part of a political union when you didn't have any actual say in it?
It's not a political union. I mean, Norway's in the single market, yeah? And they've had two referendums in Norway about joining the EU, and both times they said, well, we can't be bothered. Our voice in a European context would be so small that having our MEPs in there wouldn't make any difference. And we want to be in the single market because we want to be in the single market, but we don't want to join. For example, once we leave the EU, we'll no longer have to pay the salaries of people like Farage. He'll have to get another job, won't he?
Well, that'll be from tonight, I imagine. What do you make of this whole thing of the Norwegians and the Swiss? I mean, this was always put forward as a potential option.
It was,
and who knows? It may even still be an option if, we just do not know, really, where this is going to go. We can have some educated guesswork. But what's the point of being in those various institutions of the EU, but without actually having any say politically?
Well, I don't think there is any point in doing that. That's not the direction I ever wanted to go in.
I mean, you could say actually David Cameron and others. Maybe Margaret Thatcher was the last person that really got any, you know, big deals from the EU, because quite often we've had people going to the EU saying, oh, we're going to cut a great deal with them, and coming back with nothing, with their tail between their legs.
Yeah, and I think that's what triggered the referendum result that we got. If David Cameron had gone to Brussels in 2015 and come back with any sort of a decent deal, I suspect that the referendum would have gone the other way. I probably would have voted
the
other
referendum
way.
Actually yeah. about immigration? Wasn't that one of the main points in the referendum?
I think it was an issue, but if you look at the polls immediately afterwards, why people voted to leave, those who did, I think immigration was third on the list, something like that. It was there, but actually sovereignty and democracy came above it.
Martin, what do you make of this angle on the referendum? And do you think Britain is becoming less tolerant, more racist?
Well, I think, as I've said before, you don't have to be racist to vote for Leave, but most of the racists did. You know, I mean, that's just a fact. I'm not saying that you are. I'm not accusing you of that at all. So that's not that. But at the same time, I think what's interesting from my point of view is if you analyse the election results on December the 12th, if that election had been carried out on any other voting system common in Europe, you wouldn't have a Tory government and you wouldn't have an 80 majority and we wouldn't be leaving. We'd probably be going for a second referendum. Now, what's going to happen now is we're going to have a no-deal Brexit this time next year, that's pretty clear, which a slim majority, don't want.
Steve, do you think we'll have a no-deal Brexit?
No, I don't think that at all. I think... We won't have a comprehensive partnership deal of whatever kind it might be. I think that it'll take a long time to get to that. But I think by the end of this year, we will have the framework of a deal, the governance will be in place, and then what I suspect we'll end up with is little bits of deals, little side deals, one about fish and one about cars and whatever else there might be as we go along. But no, I don't think we'll have a no-deal Brexit, a cliff edge, or whatever else.
One of the things, David Davis, who seems to have disappeared, he was the Brexit minister for a long time, he resigned over the backstop, I believe.
Yes.
He's saying that we're going to get something. It's going to be a bit like CITA, the Canada deal. And that may even be announced next week, that's the kind of deal that we're going to be angling for. Do you think that's a... Maybe I should ask you first, Martin. Do you think it's a good idea to have a deal like the Canadians have got with the EU?
I'm not blasé about the fact that there's going to be a deal. I think everybody's trying... I mean, the European Union would prefer a deal.
Hang on, because they've already done this deal with the Canadians. Can't we just say, well, look, you've done this deal... Hang on, Martin. You've done this deal with the Canadians. Now, do it with us.
Well, Canada's a different country, to state the bleeding obvious, and the deal's got to be different. There's no fishing issue with the Canadians, for example, which is going to be a major issue.
Yeah, but surely what I'm saying is it could be the basis for a deal.
Well, I mean, it could be the basis for any kind of deal, but the point is if you're going to say it's got to be done by this time next year, which is what the Prime Minister said, then you can't actually finesse it. You will definitely, if he doesn't extend in June, you're going to be running up against a deadline. And, of course, the EU thinks that we're running up against a deadline, Johnson will blink first and do a deal which his own backbenchers might not be happy with, but if he's got a majority of 80, he might be able to push it through. But I think the fact is that they're going to demand pretty much, they're certainly not, the EU negotiators, going to allow Britain to become a Trojan horse undermining the EU policy to help the Americans in their trade wars. That is definitely their bottom line. The French people are still on strike, on their general strike, and not having their workers put on the dole to keep British workers happy. That's not going to be the way.
Well, it stands for. Anyone like to guess what it stands for, Sitter?
Oh, it's the Canada-Europe Trade Agreement?
Well, that's
something like that.
It's the EU-Canada Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement. So that's, what we're going to be looking at. Anyway, let's hear now from his final speech in the European Parliament. And there'll be probably most Europeans and certainly most MEPs will be rather glad to see the back of old Nigel Farage.
So this is it, the final chapter, the end of the road. A 47-year political experiment that the British, frankly, have never been very happy with. My mother and father signed up to a common market, not to a political union, not to flags, anthems, presidents, and now you even want your own army. For me, it's been 27 years of campaigning and over 20 years here in this Parliament. But the most significant point is this. What happens at 11 p.m. this Friday, the 31st of January, 2020, marks the point of no return. Once we've left, we are never coming back, and the rest, frankly, is detail. We're going, we will be gone. I walked in here, you all thought it was terribly funny. You stopped laughing in 2016. But my view has changed of Europe since I joined. In 2005, I saw the constitution that had been drafted by Giscard and others. I saw it rejected by the French in a referendum. I saw it rejected by the Dutch in a referendum. And I saw you in these institutions ignore them, bring it back as the Lisbon Treaty, and boast you could ram it through without there being referendums. Well, the Irish did have a vote and did say no and were forced to vote again. You're very good at making people vote again, but what we've proved is the British are too big to bully, thank goodness. So I became an outright opponent of the entire European project. I want Brexit to start a debate across the rest of Europe. What do we want from Europe? If we want trade, friendship, cooperation, reciprocity, we don't need a European Commission. We don't need a European Court. We don't need these institutions and all of this power. And I can promise you, both in UKIP and indeed in the Brexit Party, we love Europe. We just hate the European Union. It's as simple as that. So I'm hoping this begins the end of this project. It's a bad project. It isn't just undemocratic, it's anti-democratic, and it gives people power without accountability. People who cannot be held to account by the electorate, and that is an unacceptable structure. Indeed, there's an historic battle going on now across the West, in Europe, America, and elsewhere. It is globalism against populism. And you may loathe populism, but I tell you a funny thing, it's becoming very popular. And it has great benefits. No more financial contributions. No more European Court of Justice. No more common fisheries policy. No more being talked down to. No more being bullied. No more Guy Verhofstadt. I mean, what's not to like? I know you're going to miss us. I know you want to ban our national flags, but we're going to wave you goodbye. And we'll look forward in the future to working with you as sovereign.
If you disobey the rules, you get cut off. Could we please remove the flags? Mr. Farage, could we remove the flags, please?
Well, that's it. It's all over. Finished. He's gone.
Could I please ask for quiet? Yeah. Please sit down, resume your seats, put your flags away, you're leaving, and take them with you if you are leaving now. And goodbye. Can I just say, the word hate was used in the last contribution. And I really think, given what we listened to prior to this, that we should not hate anyone or any nation or any people.
So Nigel Farage bows ungracefully out of the European Parliament. She's referring there, Martin, to him saying, love Europe, hate the EU. Do you think he was using the wrong words there?
Well, I mean, she's picking him up on using hate, but I think she cut him off because they were waving flags, which I presume is against the rules of the EU Parliament. That's why she'd cut him off. And, of course, she's Irish.
What about the points that he's making, though? Well, say, for example, he's saying, we won't be back. Now, I would imagine there's quite a lot of people within the Labour Party who are thinking, well, if we get back into power, we may reapply.
He can say that, but, I mean, it's not necessarily the case, is it? It may or may not be so.
I don't think we'll be back for a little while, at least. I think there will be a campaign, and it's already starting to rejoin the EU, and no doubt the Lib Dems will run on that ticket whenever we have another election. Maybe the Labour Party will as well, I don't know. But I think the public are sick of it, frankly. I think we've been having these arguments for however long it's been, and tonight, whether people are celebrating the fact that we're leaving or not, I think people will be celebrating the fact that that argument finally is over. And I'm not convinced any party coming out in a few years' time and trying to start it again is going to meet with a very warm reception.
It's about 45 years we've been arguing over it, isn't it?
I think, yeah, something like that. It's become more prominent in recent years. But yeah, and I don't think the argument will ever go away. But I don't think the public are, or the majority of the public are in a position where they're going to come out and support people who want to open it all up again now.
Now, just one point before we finish with Brexit. Is it a super state or not? I'll ask you first, Martin.
No, as I said earlier, it's basically a fudge. I was involved in Eastern Europe, as you know, in the 90s, and the whole question of which countries were going to be allowed in, on what basis they were going to be allowed in. Yugoslavia, where I used to go a lot, some countries are in the EU, some countries are not in the EU, and there's a whole question about whether they should be in the EU. That is going to carry on going on, whether we're in it or not. I mean, basically, we've walked away, but the EU will carry on muddling along.
Not yet. I think it's been moving in that direction for a long time. And I think give it another 30 or 40 years. I don't think the whole of the EU will be a super state. My prediction is there'll be a core of countries, France, Germany, probably Italy, Spain, who will have essentially formed a single state. And then there'll be an outer ring of countries that have a looser relationship. And that might well be where we then come back in the outer ring.
Martin Schulz, who's the leader of one of the German political parties, says there must be, in the imperative, there must be a United States of Europe by 2025. Otherwise, the EU may, countries may start leaving the EU, and it may not go in the right direction. So there are certainly people out there talking about a United States of Europe.
Oh, there are. I think Nigel Farage there mentioned Guy Verhofstadt, who's been banging on about this for a long time. And I think it will. I don't think it'll happen by 2025, but I think it will happen. But not all of the 27 states that are left after 11 o'clock tonight will be part of it.
Ursula von der Leyen did make a speech about the United States of Europe, but then she rode back on it. It says in politico.eu, von der Leyen's rowing back on United States of Europe speech. Commission President-elect, well, that's before she actually became a Commission President, extended an olive branch to Eastern and Central European countries in an interview. This is literally, it's about 3 or 4 months ago. She no longer advocates for the European Union to become a federal state after previously calling for the bloc to turn into a United States of Europe.
Well, it's interesting, this, isn't it? Because it was the British in particular who pushed for a rapid extension of the EU to Eastern Europe.
Winston Churchill, I believe.
Well, no, I'm talking about more recently than that.
Winston Churchill
certainly talked about the United States of Europe at the end of the war, for sure, but that's a long time ago. The big issue in the 90s was whether the EU should be rapidly expanded to the east, and the British, with American support, pushed for that to happen. And, of course, the Germans, in particular, were very much more dubious about that. And they were not very happy, but they agreed to it. And now, of course, you've got countries at very different levels of development in the same... you've got the euro was brought in the Baltic states, absolutely disastrous for their economy. but they did it because they wanted to be part of the club. And that, of course, is why lots of their young people ended up in the rest of Europe, because there's, the economy there has been ruined.
I mean, by ceding control of your currency, is that actually mean you don't control the country anymore? That you might as well have given it to somebody foreigner?
Well, it does imply that, yes. And if you're a small countries like that, I mean, I used to work over there, as you know, Tony, and I used to argue with all of them that you don't really want to join the European Union in the current form the way it is, and you certainly don't want to give it the currency. But, of course, the Poles have still got the zloty, which allows them some room for manoeuvre. But the Baltic states, because of their closeness to Russia and the determination to break away from the Soviet Union, they jumped at the chance to join the euro. But, of course, that priced their industries completely out of the
market. So is Britain sailing off into the Atlantic on its own, or are there going to be other countries going to follow us
out? Well, it's obviously the worry for the
Italians and the Greeks.
The worry for the
EU
leadership is that may happen. But, of course, the East European countries are not going to do that, because they're basically net recipients of EU funds. And if they walk, I mean, basically, they're still knocking at the door trying to get in. I mean, you know, Bosnia would like to be in but can't be because it's not ready and all the rest of it. So that debate is going to carry on. I don't see the EU evolving into a super state because it's just so, there's so many different disparate factions. What the original conception of the EU was, it would basically be France and Germany and the Benelux countries. And they didn't even want the Italians in, but the Italians insisted that they were going to be in, even though they weren't, in fact, originally conceived as part of it. So what's happened over time is, instead of just being a coherent Northern European structure, it's become a vast rambling house with loads and loads of bits of, sheds and things like the Baltic states knocked on. And that's one of the reasons why it won't be a super state, because it's just such a rambling mess.
Okay,
really.
Well, enough about Brexit for maybe for another few years, hopefully.
Until the end of the year.
The mayor said, that's Bristol's Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, that there was no time to approach more than one firm to do the Temple Island development. So this is the big piece of land. I think it's connected by Temple, by the Bridge to Nowhere, that's been derelict there. It's been flattened for about 4 or 5 years, and a lot of, I suppose, fun being made of the council. Well, why have we got this bridge and then nothing's actually being done there? But anyway, there has been a proposal now put forward for the site, but according to the mayor, there was only time to have one person bidding for it. Now, this is quite an important site in the city, very close to Temple Meads. What do you make of the way that the city's actually dealt with this? Because there were originally, I think, plans for the arena in that area.
It was, yeah. And it transpired recently that the mayor and the administration have been talking to Legal and General pretty much since they came in, or even before, in 2016. So the idea that there wasn't time to talk to anybody else when this has been going on for 4 years is a little bit questionable.
Have you got any evidence that the mayor's been talking for 4 years to Legal and General?
Yeah, there was something that came out. The question was asked, I can't remember which scrutiny meeting it was, the community scrutiny, I think, within the last few weeks. A representative from Legal and General was asked, how long have you been speaking to the administration about this? And the answer came out, since 2016, I think it was.
So why shouldn't they just go to a developer and say, right, you're going to do it?
Well, because we've got EU laws that say if you want to get a developer to build something...
We haven't. Very soon we won't have.
Well, we will have, because they carry on. We have procurement laws there for a reason. They're there, and whether we keep the ones we've got now, whether we create our own UK procurement laws in the future, those rules are there to prevent corruption.
The mayor is eager to get this development moving. You can't wait around to go through some sort of year-long tendering process.
No, that's fine, and there are ways of doing that. If he wanted to simply dispose of the land to LNG and let them get on with it, he could do that. He could sell the land on the open market tomorrow. But what he's doing at the moment is, frankly, a bit of an iffy deal, where we as a city sell a long lease of that land to LNG, and then if LNG just coincidentally happened to build the kind of office building that we'd like them to build, we guarantee that with taxpayers' money we will lease that building off them, and we take the risk then of whether or not we can actually get a tenant in it and get some money in. And what that is effectively a way of getting around procurement law, where we get LNG to build a building for us without having gone out to tender.
So why hasn't he done that? Well, he has done it.
That's what he has done. Yeah. That's what he has done.
Is it legal?
Yeah-ish. Depends who you ask.
He's probably taken legal advice, and they've told him, yes, this is okay.
Yeah. Now, I've got to be careful here, because I've seen some of that legal advice, which is exempt and not in the public eye, so I can't repeat what it says, I get myself in all sorts of trouble.
Well, you're doing quite well if you can even remember it, actually.
But I think the concern I have is that there is a risk. It's a complicated deal. It's an innovative deal, which you could sell as a good thing, but in legal terms, innovative is rarely good. And there's a massive risk that it could get challenged. And I don't know. I'm not a procurement lawyer. I don't know whether that challenge would be successful or not. What I do know is that it'd be expensive and it'd be time-consuming.
Does sound as if the mayor is rather close to these developers and not necessarily really listening to other councillors, other people in the city. Very easy, isn't it, to just have a chat with a developer in a pub and say, right, you've got the deal.
Well, I mean, I'm not, as you know, Tony, I'm not in favour of elected mayors anyway. They were brought in by the Conservative government, as you know, some years ago.
This sort of deal could have been done by a council leader in the previous system.
Well, indeed, but the council leader in the previous system would have had checks and balances on them to do it, at least within their own party. Whereas, of course, the power of the mayor, the whole idea of it, was they can do innovative deals, as has been suggested. And whether that's a good thing or not, I generally tend to think it isn't, you know. Don't broke, don't fix it.
One thing which Bristol is rolling out is called 5G. It's the next generation mobile data, and there's quite an active little group. Well, I say they're little, but very, very strong-minded group in the city that think that the 5G technology is actually very damaging to our health and are demanding, really, that the technology companies, the council and central government prove that this technology is safe, because they say they've got evidence that proves it's not safe and that it's very damaging to health. And I spoke earlier this week to Lucy Harper from one of the fairly new group called Bristol Against 5G, and that's going to be the full version of this interview is going to be on our Dialect show next Tuesday at noon. But let's have a listen to Lucy Harper now.
There's thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed studies showing that there's a link between your exposure, even to 3G and 4G, to brain tumours. We know that mobile phones are linked to brain tumours. There's lots of studies to show that. And what's really interesting is if it's an independent study will show adverse health effects 68% of the time. If it's an industry-funded study, it only shows adverse health effects maybe sort of 26% of the time. So there's a massive discrepancy. Public Health England are basing their guidelines on an organisation called the International Committee for Non-Ionised Radiation Protection, which is an American-based company, and they are what you call captured. So there's lots of people from the telecommunications industry within that group, and the same applies to the World Health Organization.
So that's Lucy Harper from Bristol Against 5G. Sounds like she's done her homework, Steve, that she's actually gone back and looked at, okay, so they say it's safe, and checked up where it says it's safe, and actually it looks like, from what she's saying there, it's mostly the industry itself which is deciding whether this technology is safe or not.
Well, it's not the industry, it's Public Health England, who are the people who are there.
They've just taken their decision or their recommendations from this other European group, which is the industry.
Well, no, they haven't. What they've done, and this came, and I think it was actually Lucy who presented a petition in council a few months ago, and as it happened, I was the person from our Conservative group who stood up and spoke on this. So I did a bit of research here as well.
You did your homework too.
I did. And what Public Health England have done is they based their advice on the international guidelines. It's not an international committee that says this is safe. What the international committee does is it's worked out what level of radiation causes harm to human health and below what level it is safe to be exposed. And these are internationally agreed guidelines. It's not just the telecoms industry. It's not, you know, US big business or some sort of conspiracy here. Every country in the world uses these guidelines. What Public Health England have done is they've reviewed all of the available studies. They've looked at the UK advisory committee to the government who advise on these things, the same one with the EU, the World Health Organization, the UN. All of them are saying that at the levels of exposure of non-ionising radiation, which is what you get in 3G, 4G and 5G, the levels of exposure that you would get as a member of the public are way below the levels that are internationally agreed to cause harm. And the point I made when I spoke about this in council is that I'm not a scientist, I'm not well, as it happens, I did get a degree in physics, but not a very good one, and it was 20 years ago. I'm not qualified to read all these studies and interpret them. Neither, as far as I know, is the mayor. Public Health England are there to do that for us. They are an independent government-funded organisation who are there to look at the science and advise policymakers, and their advice quite clearly is that there is no risk to health.
I mean, I was looking at the various organisations that are behind rolling this out across the city. One of them is called Bristol Smart City. And I spoke briefly to a woman called Freya Lockwood, who's their person who's partly employed by the City Council, I think possibly by Business West as well. Mm-hmm. Some various one of these partnerships where, yeah, you know, you always wonder who is actually line managing this person. Is it the City Council? And it turns out often, quite often, it's not. It's some other organisation. Mm. So we're paying, but they're being managed by some other organisation. But anyway, it was interesting because Freya is actually from the military. She's from a company called Kinetic, which I don't know if Martin can help me out here. I think it's the Defence Evaluation Research Establishment it used to be.
It used to be. Yeah. It's not part of the military now.
It's now. Yeah, that's right.
It hasn't been for many years.
It was privatised.
It used to be part of the MOD.
So, I mean, it's a little bit concerning when somebody who's pushing this as a great thing for the city is actually from a military company.
Well, I don't know Freya. I don't know what her background is, but there are lots of people pushing this.
I did ask her if she would come on the radio.
Sure.
No reply.
But, you know, I've seen lots of...
In fact, that invitation is still out there for her. I should text her again tomorrow and say, come on, Freya, let's have a listen. Because it'd be fascinating to hear. Because I'm sure that, there must be some sort of, reason why that they really want to do this and something to back it up. But it seems to me as if people like her just don't want to have this debate publicly. They've just decided, well, we're going to do this and we don't want to debate about it.
Yeah. Well, we did have the debate publicly in the council. We're having it again now. But I think there are loads of benefits to this. I don't know particularly what Kinetic want out of it, if they want anything particularly out of it, or whether...
Well, that was just her previous job. I'm not saying that they've got skin in the game, necessarily.
Yeah, so... I don't think this is something the military are pushing onto Bristol. The benefits are huge. There's work that's being done at the moment at UWE around driverless cars that use this technology, and the benefit.
Is a driverless car a benefit?
Well, it is if they can communicate and talk to one another. The benefit of 5G isn't particularly.
If you get knocked down by a driverless car, who do you sue?
Well, that's a whole other issue, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's
in terms of the technology,
What you've got is a robot. The other thing is that it's the idea that when you're going from A to B, you want to sit back and read a book rather than drive the car.
Well, I personally, I came here on a motorbike. I quite like driving and being on the road. But the benefit of it is if these vehicles can talk to one another. Which is what 5G allows. And the benefit of 5G isn't particularly that it's faster and you can download a movie in a couple of minutes or whatever. It's the low latency. So the second a signal, or the millisecond a signal goes out, it's received. You don't have a lag. And that means that things like driverless cars can talk to one another and can talk to base stations. And it means that they're able to form convoys and make much more efficient use of the road space than human drivers can do. That's one benefit.
Well, actually, I get quite a few people right on my bumper. I don't think you could get any closer than they are.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily efficient. That's just dangerous.
Anyway, Martin, what do you make of this 5G?
Well, as I say, I certainly haven't got a physics degree, and I try to listen to people who've got relevant qualifications.
Well, being told that 4G isn't really fast enough. I'll be honest with you, I'm not convinced by that. Maybe there's other things like these driverless cars that need 5G.
But. Well, I'll certainly tell you what is clear. It's certainly a key element in military technology, which is why they've got all this fuss about whether Huawei are going to be allowed into the British.
Mobile data was developed by the British military.
Well, of course, the internet is effectively developed by the Pentagon, as we all know. I mean, the fact is, these are the reasons. I mean, there are economic reasons why you might not want to be on the back burner on this because other people are doing it, and there are also military reasons, which is why there's all this fuss about whether Huawei should be allowed.
And what about having a 5G mast outside your bedroom window? That doesn't sound like being very pleasant. In fact, there are all sorts of people who actually moved away from a particular flat if they found that mobile phone masts are installed on the roof and they're on the top floor. They just don't want to live next door to them.
Yeah, as it happens, I have lived in a flat with a mobile phone mast on the roof. And, this is not scientific, but didn't do me any harm.
You do see birds perching up there, don't you? Well, I suppose they sometimes fall off, but not
often. You do. And actually, one of the things with 5G is, because it runs at much higher frequency, it runs at much lower power, which is a benefit, that each mast isn't pumping out as much power of radiation as they do with 3 and 4G, what that means is you need a lot more masts to cover the area.
Okay, the diesel ban. So there's been a little bit of news just the last couple of days about the Clean Air Plan, I think some people call it.
Yes.
The diesel ban, it's known mostly around town.
It is, that's right.
What's happening?
Right, so let's rewind a few months. The council put out a consultation, and initially, let me say, I'm all in favour of having a clean air zone. We need a clean air zone. The quality of air in some parts of this city is absolutely appalling, and it can't be allowed to stand. So that's agreed. I don't think anyone would argue with that. What we got last summer, after this had already been going around for about 18 months, is you've got a consultation out with a whole bunch of options, six or seven of them, I think, before any modelling had been done, to figure out whether any of these options would actually work. Halfway through the consultation, the modelling came in, and it turned out none of the options would work, or at least not fast enough. They wouldn't clean up the air. So what the council did at the end of that consultation, about September, October...
Because this sounds like a real back-of-the-envelope job, rush job.
Completely. This is my problem with it. I'm not opposed to doing this, but we should be doing it properly, and with some measure of competence and
Well, the mayor would argue we've got to get this in place. We can't hang around, a bit like Temple Island.
Well, yeah, and he's right. But the fact is, we've been hanging around for 2 years, and now we've got this panic measure where what the council effectively did is bung together two of the options out of the six or seven that were consulted on, and without any further consultation, without any scrutiny from elected councillors, bung these measures together, pushed it through a cabinet meeting and said, right, that's what we're doing. And there are a whole...
I mean, if you compare it to, say, the resident parking zones, which were tortuous and took a long, long time with lots of consultation, it's completely the opposite.
It is completely the opposite, and the problem I have with it is a bit back of an envelope. It's been rushed through.
It just doesn't sound to me as if there's been really much of an attempt to bring the city on board with this.
No, I don't think there has. And I think most people are on board with the fact that we need to do something about air quality. But this has been pushed out with a whole load of unanswered questions, a whole load of conflicts, and bits of it that just don't work. And what we've actually seen is the mayor updating policy on the hoof on his personal blog yesterday by tweaking where the boundaries go and saying, oh, we're going to have exemptions for people going to the hospital and we're going to have exemptions
for... Well, sure, it's not just him on his personal blog. He's obviously talking to council officers who are, you know, working this policy through, isn't he?
Oh, I'm sure he is, but you don't make policy in the council by having a chat in a back room and then sticking it on your blog.
Well, yes, you do. It's just the whole point of having a mayor, is that these decisions get done quickly and we don't have to run it past the city, we don't have to run it past you councillors. It just gets done.
Well, yeah, and it's being done badly. This is the problem.
I interrupted you there. What are the changes that...
So the changes that have been made is a couple of tweaks to the boundary of the diesel ban area, which is the smaller inner one of the two zones, so that Cabot Circus is now not inside it. And the idea of that is people can go and shop at Cabot Circus instead of driving out to the Mall, helping Bristol's economy. Great.
But shouldn't they really be parking at a park and ride and getting a bus into Cabot Circus or something?
Yes, if we had enough park and rides in the right places, yes. And I'm glad that's coming. There is more park and ride coming as part of the West of England plan, but that's a few years away. So for now...
I can imagine that conversation between the mayor and the boss of Cabot Circus saying, well, you're not banning the diesels around where I am, and he's just had to go and do it.
Yeah, the mayor's words in his blog, I think, is we were challenged about this. And I can imagine, as you say, that he was. The other one they've done is they've taken the Plimsoll Bridge out of it. So if people are coming into the city from the south on the A370, then go across what the mayor now calls Western Harbour and out on Portway without having to go through the zone.
But look, the real biggie is, what about businesses that are within the zone? Because many of them have only diesel vehicles. And so are they just going to simply have to go?
Well, at the moment, yes. The exemptions that the mayor mentioned yesterday are people visiting the hospitals in town, which is great. Low-income households will get an exemption, maybe, which again is great, but I'm not quite sure how that actually works in practice. But nothing for business. And we heard yesterday from a business owner in St. Phillips who's got a gas bottle delivery business. He sends trucks out from his yard every day delivering gas bottles. Each one of his trucks would have to pay 100 quid a day to drive out of his yard. That's tens of thousands of pounds a year. The only option he would have is to up sticks and move his business out of Bristol. And he won't be the only one.
Well, but he won't even be able to deliver into the city then, will he? Into the city centre. So what solution would you like to see for the air quality rather than the diesel ban? Or are you in favour of the diesel ban?
Not just a flat diesel ban. It's too much of a blunt instrument. You know, we've got people in my world that I've spoken to, who have gone out, who are, you know, most people around my way are very environmentally conscious and want to mitigate, minimise the harm they cause. People have gone out and spent considerable amounts of money on buying a brand new Euro 6 compliant, very, very clean diesel car, precisely because they want to not harm the air quality, and they're now being told, oh, well, you can't bring it into the city anyway, whereas someone with a clapped out 15-year-old petrol car that spews out far more particulates and pollution can drive straight through. So I think it's far too blunt an instrument just to say diesel's bad and petrol's good.
Listen, I asked you, what would you do? What do you think we should be doing? Because this has to be sorted one way or another, Steve.
It does. And I think, actually, the model that's been adopted in London with the low emission zone, I think they call it an ultra-low emission zone over there, where actually it looks at a camera looks at your number plate, it knows what kind of car you're driving, it knows how polluting that particular model of car is, and you pay accordingly. So if you're driving a clean diesel, then you don't pay. If you're driving a dirty petrol, you do.
So the number plate makers in London are doing a roaring trade, I imagine.
Anyway, there's your way. But
knowing what them Londoners are like. Martin, what do you make of this? Is it fair to tell businesses that have got diesel vehicles that they either have to get a whole new fleet of vehicles or go?
Well, I think...
Doesn't sound very fair, does it?
There's a general agreement, it seems, that we've got to do something about this. The question is this the thing that we want to do? And as I said before, I'm not really in favour of a mayoral system because there isn't enough consultation about anything. And, of course, the advantage, supposedly, is that things can be pushed through, you know, decisions can be taken which would otherwise be put off. I'm listening to the arguments about it. I tend to go with Steve, you know, blunt instruments, look at what people do elsewhere. They've been doing this in London, as you say, for quite a while, so they must have some, you know, stats to go on that you can look at. I'm agnostic about it.
All right. Well, we had a fascinating discussion last week about Bristol Waste and the horrific alleged bullying of a whistleblower in her late 50s who'd been working there for 3 or 4 years at Bristol Waste, an incredible litany of real physical violence. And I did contact Bristol Waste this week, and their spokesperson, Emma Russell, sent me this statement. "We take complaints of this nature very seriously and have zero tolerance for the issues raised. We've already conducted a full and thorough internal investigation into the concerns raised with us. This was initiated at a management request and no allegations were upheld." So I suppose what we're being told there is that the Evening Post story was nonsense. So that's none of those were upheld, then it doesn't sound like the, that's totally undermined what the Evening Post is saying. At least that's there, what's what they're saying. She goes on, "We refute the characterisation of some of the concerns, and in line with our new whistleblowing policy, we are now conducting a formal investigation run by an independent third party, where we will be seeking evidence to substantiate the claims." Now, Steve, what's going on with Bristol Waste? By the way, the independent third party is Bristol Energy, which is also owned by Bristol Holdings Company. So that's overseeing the third-party investigation. So it doesn't sound actually 100% independent. Can you say something about Bristol Waste and Bristol Energy and Bristol Holding Company? Because this sounds like, to me, like a private business, which is just publicly funded, and they don't really have to make a profit. And they're also quite secretive, really, because, private businesses are entitled to be, and public are supposed to be, but this one isn't.
No, they're not, and it is a concern. To be honest, these allegations aside, and obviously I don't know whether these are what's really going on in there or not. If half of what was written in the Bristol Post is true, it sounds absolutely appalling and a horrendous culture to work in. But I think that does need to be properly looked into. This isn't the place to try and resolve that. In terms of the companies more broadly, actually it's Bristol Energy which concerns me more than Bristol Waste. Bristol Waste actually is at least breaking even. It's making a little bit of money. It does a reasonable job. There's always issues.
It's not really making money, is it? Because it's publicly funded.
Well, the council pays it to do what it... to provide the service back to the council. So the council is both its owner and its biggest customer. But if the council were paying any other provider, to do the same job, or indeed doing bringing the service in-house and doing it in-house, I'm not sure it would cost any
more
or less.
The reason that this hits home, this story from the whistleblower, is because it's publicly funded and because the allegations are so serious. On-duty cocaine use by a street cleaner who allegedly still works there, 18 physical assaults against Mrs. Probert by another employee, 20 men bullying, verbally abusing and refusing to work with her, colleagues spitting on the floor in front of her and branding her. Well, I can't say that. One of the things that they I can say, though, is branding her a witch. Lazy street cleaners refusing to get out of Bristol waste vans to clean the city streets. In other words, and I was just hearing from someone else saying, oh, yeah, I quite often used to go past the Bristol waste van and they're all just sitting in the cab. But maybe they're just having their lunch. But anyway, so these are pretty serious allegations, aren't they?
Yeah, of course they are, absolutely. And as I from what that statement from Bristol Waste says, they're being investigated. Whether it's being done by the right person, I don't know. I don't really want to get in the middle of this while it's being investigated at the moment. Like I said, if what's being alleged there, if even part of that is true, it's horrible, and nobody would want to work in an environment like that.
Sounds to me, Martin Summers, like the Bristol Waste, Bristol Holdings, Bristol Energy have got all the advantages of someone who's publicly funded, but also all the advantages of a private company. You don't have to tell you anything really much about what they do.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is an issue about the whole structure of these kind of companies, but that's a bigger issue, isn't it? And, of course, the fact that Bristol Energy doesn't seem to make any money and it might be a white elephant and all the rest of it. One of the things that does concern me, though, I mean, the allegations that she's making are actually criminal offences. And, of course, the obvious retort would be you shouldn't be complaining to your managers about this.
Well,
you should be going to
the
police.
I mean, her argument was I'd rather talk to my bosses and get this sorted out rather than make a big scene and get the police involved, etc. So she thought the management were going to get them sorted out.
Okay, well, I mean, as Steve has just said, we can't really discuss allegations like that in any serious way. I wasn't there. I didn't see what happened, nor did any of the people in this room. But these allegations should be taken seriously, and they should be properly investigated.
So what Emma Russell told me was that once the investigation is finished by Bristol Holding Company, Bristol Energy, which... It doesn't sit very well that it's the company that owns Bristol Waste that's going to be doing the investigation, or a parallel company, Steve, does it? I mean, surely if it's independent, it shouldn't be part of the same business network or, you know, same ownership.
No. And, you know, I've had dealt with issues like this in big companies before, not of this sort of seriousness, thankfully, but where you've wanted to bring someone independent in, you don't bring someone in from a sister company. You know, there are HR advisory companies out there who specialise in doing this kind of thing. I would have thought you'd use one of those, but as I said, I'm not inside Bristol Waste. I'm not involved. I don't know what's going on in there. And while these are really serious things, they are potentially criminal. I think it's unwise to try and get too deeply into it, yeah. And comment at
I
this
mean,
stage.
My main beef with this is if you're going to have an investigation, it should either be a police investigation or it should be completely independent. And if this one doesn't look on the surface of it as if it's independent at all from the same ownership structure of businesses. Historic Motion, this is from a couple of weeks ago. Historic Motion puts decision-making in the hands of Bristol citizens. Steve, sounds great, doesn't it? One of the biggest shake-up in years in how decisions are taken on the major issues in Bristol is approved with the introduction of citizens' assemblies. The City Council's ruling Labour group threw its weight behind the Green Party's idea with backing from the Lib Dems. So what are these citizens' assemblies, and are they taking over from you councillors?
Well, that's an excellent question. And as it happens, this is another one that we debated in council a few weeks ago. And actually, I spoke in that debate, and I was one of the lone voices speaking against the idea. And the reason I spoke against it is not just because I'm a nasty reactionary Tory and don't want to get people involved. And it's not because I'm sort of want to jealously guard all the power for myself and think councillors should get involved in everything. But there's a reason we have representative democracy. And there's a reason that we have an open market in ideas when it comes to debating these things.
Okay, so these citizens' assembly, will they be making decisions or will they be making recommendations and discussing things?
Well, that's really unclear. We don't know is the answer.
You need to know. Sure, well, you can back so. Something like that or not.
Well, that's why I didn't back it. The phrase that my colleague, my group leader, Mark Weston, used in the debate is that what we're going to end up with here is consultation on speed. And I think he's probably
some
right.
Steroids, I think he said.
Steroids, did he say? Sorry, okay. Same principle. And I think that's right. I honestly, knowing the temperament of the elected mayor, I can't imagine him being willing to surrender his power and simply say to a group of people in a room, go on then, crack on, you make the decision. He's not willing to let elected councillors make any decisions. I don't think he's going to let a random group of,
well,
of members of the public.
Well, this is the other
it.
Question, is how random is the group? So who gets to choose the group? Because we quite often get here, oh, it is an independent group. Well, actually, somebody somewhere has said, right, I want you, and you to do it.
And that's exactly the concern. Well, that's one of the two concerns that I really had with this, is the moment you start doing this, as you say, somebody in an office somewhere in City Hall is selecting a group of people. And the moment someone you can't see gets to choose, that's when I start to get a little bit nervous about it. The idea behind it is that you use demographic information to get a cross-section of people, a bit like jury duty. And that's fine, but I'm not convinced that having a cross-section in terms of ages and ethnicities and what part of the city people come from and whatever other characteristics you use, I don't think that gives you a cross-section of ideas.
Oh, especially if, you know, quite a lot of them are members of Common Purpose or some other nefarious kind of lobbying organisation. But anyway...
Well, I am a Common Purpose graduate here. Declaration of interest many years ago.
Anyway, this is a little bit similar, isn't it, to what's happened with Western Harbour. There's been a whole kind of list of people deciding what's happening. What are your thoughts on what's going on over there? The advisory group it doesn't contain any councillors from Western Harbour. Someone from Hope Community Church, which is the mayor's church.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Grazier from Bristol Property Agents, an architect. David Miller, someone from Cumberland Basin Stakeholder Group, Underfall Yard, Business West, James Jury, and it looks as if it's going to be chaired by John Savage from Bristol Chamber of Commerce. So,
isn't everything chaired by John Savage? I mean, he's a very nice guy, but...
Well, he was on this programme, I think, a few years ago. He said, I'd just like to say I'm not a megalomaniac. Anyway,
he's not. He's actually a lovely guy. But it does remember. It's the standard who's who in Bristol. Before I was a councillor, I in a previous job, I was chief executive of a local charity, Young Bristol. And in that role, I used to get invited to various gatherings of the great and the good. And you could list who would be in the room before you walked in, because it was always the same faces. And it was James Jury, and it was John Savage, and it was all of these people. And this is another gathering of the usual suspects. And they're all good people, and they're all in the positions they're in because they've got experience and talent and ability, but that doesn't make them representative of the people that are actually affected.
We're
going
to be talking about the coronavirus in the second hour, Steve. Mm. What are your thoughts about the... we just had the first two cases apparently confirmed in the UK, but they're being sent up to Newcastle to be put in isolation. The vaccine company GlaxoSmithKline in Italy, I was sent an article in Italian, so I can't absolutely confirm it, but they're saying apparently in Italy that they reckon by the end of next week they will have a vaccine that will deal with this virus.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that's the case, I think that's amazing.
Well, it's amazing for their shareholders. Anyway,
you're so cynical.
I know, I'm terribly cynical.
You know what, if it stops hundreds more people from dying, I'm happy with that.
Okay, well, thanks to our guest, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henleys, Steve Smith. Amazingly, he managed to do all sorts of subjects that you knew loads of stuff about. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world.
On the Hour, live from the Sky News Centre.